be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo de Landeros Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an Oregon soldier is charged with the kidnapping and murder of an Iraqi civilian. Voters in Michigan approve a ballot measure to ban affirmative action in their state's public sector, and a group of international attorneys file court documents alleging that Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has committed war crimes.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there are 2,853 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. IraqBodyCount.org reports 52,142 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. A new report by The Lancet places the civilian death count at more than 650,000.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 14th, 2006. I'm Isaac Kaplan-Woolner.
And I'm Mike Monkwold. A Camp Pendleton Marine charged with kidnapping and murder in the death of an Iraqi man pleaded not guilty at his arraignment today. Corporal Trent Thomas was part of a squad accused of kidnapping and killing a 52-year-old man in the Iraqi village of Hamdaniya and then trying to cover the incident up. Thomas faces several charges, including kidnapping, murder, and conspiracy. Of the seven other troops in the case, three have pleaded guilty to reduced charges in return for their testimony about the incident. Under the plea deal, other charges will be dropped. Some of the testimony from those men singled out Thomas's actions the night of April 26th. One of the troops in the case said Thomas fired several rounds into the victim's chest.
Whether it's the Iraq War or the efforts of anti-war activists, more Portland students are opting to keep personal information away from recruiters, according to the Oregonian. Under the No Child Left Behind law, public schools must provide recruiters with the names, phone numbers, and addresses of students, unless students or their parents ask to be excluded. 61% of Portland Public Schools juniors and seniors told schools to do just that, according to a district count. That's up from 24% in 2004. Workers and volunteers with the Military and Draft Counseling Project and Recruiter Watch PDX visited several high schools in September and distributed pamphlets which encouraged students to withhold information. Maureen Meisner, Education Services Specialist for the U.S. Army Recruiting Battalion, said recruiters report making few inroads in Portland public schools.
An officer accused of asking women to lift their skirts during a traffic stop pleaded guilty to official misconduct and resigned from the Portland Police Bureau. John Wood had his police certification revoked as part of a plea bargain. He faces 2 years of probation and 100 hours of community service. He wrote letters of apology to the two women who read them after Monday's hearing, said their attorney, John Allison. The women told detectives they had spoken with Wood as they were leaving a Portland night spot on July 21st, according to interview records released by police. Wood was in the parking lot in a patrol car. He is the second Portland police officer to come under scrutiny recently for inappropriate demands during traffic stops.
Oregon will not be allowed to change the way its schools are rated under the federal No Child Left Behind Act. The state was hoping to be chosen for a pilot project which would let schools be rated according to the progress each student makes rather than the percentage of students who pass the state's academic tests. Federal officials are concerned that the scores needed to pass the tests might not wholly measure what students are supposed to learn. Every state in this growth model pilot program needs to have an up-to-date, approved student testing system. So that lets out Oregon. Oregon may reapply in a year or two once tests are reviewed and passing scores determined. The five states cleared to use a student growth model for their ratings are North Carolina, Tennessee, Delaware, Arkansas, and Florida.
The National Weather Service in Portland has issued a high wind watch for tomorrow morning through the afternoon for the North Oregon, Central, and South Washington coasts. Cities affected include Astoria, Cannon Beach, Tillamook, Lincoln City, Newport, Florence, Raymond, and Long Beach. The watch remains in effect through tomorrow afternoon. Peak gusts at headlands and beaches may exceed 60 miles an hour. Earlier, the Weather Service in Medford issued a high wind watch for the south central Oregon coast and the Curry County for tomorrow also. Cities that could be impacted are Coos Bay, North Bend, Reedsport, Coquille, Brookings, Harbor, and Gold Beach. In eastern Washington, the Weather Service has issued a winter storm warning, starting at midnight for the east slopes of the Cascades, with a high wind watch tomorrow on the east slopes.
A new power outage was reported this morning in southeast Portland, affecting at least 1,500 Portland General Electric customers. PGE spokesman Ariana White says the utility was able to restore all the customers. White says there was a problem with the switch, and they were able to reroute all customers who were sitting in the dark. White says the first call came in about 5:30 a.m., and PGE crews could not isolate the problem right away. But when they did, they were able to restore the 1,500 customers to power at about 9 a.m. PGE crews have been working nonstop since a powerful windstorm Sunday night left about 65,000 customers throughout the region without electricity. PGE has restored power to the majority of those customers.
Southern Oregon University has invoked a seldom-used provision that could lead to cuts in programs and dismissals of tenured teachers. The school's enrollment figures have been falling steadily for years, and expenses for benefits and utilities have increased, President Mary Cullinan said in a campus speech Monday. Soon after the start of winter term January 8th, she said, she would decide whether to declare a condition requiring reduction or elimination of a program, prompting potential cuts. The declaration would let Cullinan terminate contracts with tenured and tenure-track professors. Despite cuts in travel, energy savings, and unfilled positions, the school dipped into its reserve account for $1.6 million last year and will go for nearly $960,000 in reserves this year, she said.
On the eve of this year's midterm election, KBOO political reporter Michael Gene Horowitz covered the birth of the 110th Congress. He joins us now live 1 week later to discuss some remaining questions. Michael, thanks for joining us live in Studio 2.
Great to be here, Mike.
So on election eve, you cautioned that the Democratic majority rested on shaky ground, namely Senator Joe Lieberman, who is principally elected by Connecticut Republicans. Has Lieberman given any indication he might not caucus with the Democrats?
Well, unfortunately, Mike, Lieberman told Associated Press over the weekend that he wouldn't rule out caucusing with the Republicans if the Democrats acted irresponsibly. Of course, nobody knows what that means. That's up for Lieberman to decide.
Okay, and moving right along to the House, where Speaker Pelosi has backed anti-war champion John Murtha to replace Steny Hoyer as Democratic leader. Do you think that Murtha will prevail on Thursday?
Yeah, when they elect the majority leader for the House. It's unlikely, Mike. Key liberals like Henry Waxman and Barney Frank are supporting Hoyer, partly to protect their shot at chairmanships, but also to ensure support for social liberalism that Murtha hasn't previously supported. Abortion, gay rights, gun control, that sort of thing.
Okay, and one last question for you. On election eve, you predicted that the Democrats would enjoy a quantity of seats in the mid-230s, yet the AP has thus far counted only 229. What's gone wrong, and will this matter to the Democrats?
Well, it's always nice to have 235 instead of 229. Nothing's gone wrong. 11 races are still undecided. The Democrats are certain to pick up one, because that's a runoff in Louisiana in which two Democrats face off each other. So that's heads you win, tails you know, you lose kind of thing. But they're likely to pick up three others. So there's some very close races. They have leads in a couple of 600 to 1,000 votes. So we're just going to have to wait over the next couple of weeks to see if we do hit those mid-230s that KBOO predicted.
All right. Thank you very much. That was KBOO's political reporter, Michael Gene Horowitz, giving us an update on the 110th Congress. Under a recent U.S. Department of Education decision, Oregon will not be allowed to change the way its schools are rated. A team of international attorneys filed papers in Germany today alleging that Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, along with 13 other U.S. officials, have committed war crimes. In two other court cases, the Bush administration is providing a broad interpretation of the Military Commissions Act, the law dealing with the detention of so-called enemy combatants. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell follows both of these stories.
A 380-page complaint was filed on behalf of 11 detainees held at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq and one detainee held at Guantanamo Bay Detention Center in Cuba. They say they were tortured while in U.S. custody, which is a violation of the Geneva Conventions. The lawyers say they have substantial evidence beyond victim testimony that the 12 men were tortured and that the treatment was authorized at the top of the chain, starting with Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. The complaint was filed in a German court, which has universal jurisdiction. Michael Ratner, director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, is filing the complaint.
Our goal here really is to try and get that criminal investigation opened. At this point, for some 5 years now, U.S. high officials have engaged in really what I call a torture program from Guantanamo to Abu Ghraib, and nothing has been done about it, sadly, except with the so-called few bad apples at the bottom who are not really that compared to really what people at the top of this chain of command authorized. So our goal here is to get an investigation, and there's really nowhere else to turn now. You can't go to U.S. courts any longer. There's no international criminal court that can do anything. We really have to go to the national courts of various countries.
A German court dismissed a previous try in 2004. The prosecutor said the United States had not completed its own investigation into allegations of torture. Attorneys say now is a good time to refile that case for two reasons. One, the passage of the Military Commissions Act, which gives guidelines on unjust treatment of detainees and gives immunity to U.S. officials involved in any interrogation since September 11, 2001. Attorneys say this proves the U.S. will not open its own investigations into torture and instead will protect those who could have engaged or authorized the treatment. And the second reason,
that Rumsfeld has resigned and will presumably be out of the office within a few days to a few weeks. To the extent he had any kind of immunity for what he did as a high-level official, that will be gone and will be much more open to a criminal investigation.
The German court is expected to decide its action on the complaint at the beginning of 2007, and the Department of Justice says they won't comment on it until that happens. And back in the United States, other court cases have been filed that directly challenge the Military Commissions Act. In one case in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, the administration writes in their brief that the Military Commissions Act authorized the government to detain any foreign national believed to be an enemy combatant, despite their location, including those living in the United States. Ali Almari, a lawful immigrant from Qatar living in the United States, was picked up for terrorism, classified as an enemy combatant, and forced to forfeit his right to challenge his detention, also known as habeas corpus. Jonathan Hafitz, attorney for Almari, says this is the first case of its kind.
The only case where the president has arrested an individual, declared an enemy combatant, an individual who was arrested and is being held in the United States. He's being held in a South Carolina jail, and he's been held without charge, and now he's going to be held, according to the government, without his right to habeas corpus to challenge his detention. He's the only individual in this position.
But the Military Commissions Act is less than a month old, and some fear Almari could be the first of many immigrants living in the United States who could lose the right to challenge their detention. That broad interpretation was brought up, but largely ignored during congressional debate of the law last September. Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont will chair the Judiciary Committee come December. He calls this a concern.
I have a strong disagreement with the administration on habeas corpus, and I suspect we'll probably be having some major hearings in the Judiciary Committee on that.
In another court case filed in Washington challenging the constitutionality of the Military Commissions Act, the United States defended the act's legality. These cases could reach the Supreme Court. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
30 Woodfin Suites hotel workers in Emeryville, California, face termination from their jobs. Most workers are immigrant women of color who say the threat is retaliation to their organizing efforts. Free Speech Radio News' Christina Anistad reports.
Woodfin Suites has issued 30 no-match Social Security letters to their employees. Workers say Woodfin Suites Hotel is retaliating against them after they filed a lawsuit against the hotel for back pay. The suit could cost Woodfin's tens of thousands of dollars. Sarah Knorr is an organizer with EBASE, the East Bay Alliance for a Sustainable Economy.
As soon as we started talking about Measure C, managers started retaliating against workers. They one time brought a whole bunch of workers up to the attic and told them immigration was outside. About a month ago, the hotel tried a whole new tactic. They told the workers that all of a sudden they found problems with almost all of their Social security numbers. A lot of these workers have worked at this very hotel since it opened 6 years ago. Funny, there was never a problem with their social security numbers before they started speaking up for their rights.
Last year, Emeryville voters passed Measure C, a law that requires hotels to pay their employees a livable wage. Under Measure C, hotels in Emeryville are required to pay their workers a minimum of $9 an hour and non-managerial workers an average of $11 an hour. If employees clean more than 5,000 square feet a day, the hotel must pay their workers time and a half. Organizers and workers say the hotel company has refused to comply with the measure. New hotel manager Hugh McIntosh says Woodfin Suites in Emeryville is complying with Measure C.
We have no intention of retaliating against them. And as a matter of fact, we're offering to pay our employees to clarify any misunderstandings that exist between the information that we have on file for them in the Social Security Administration. And that's a good indication of how much we care for our employees and how much we're concerned for their well-being.
McIntosh adds that the hotel is only responding to a letter from Social Security. But workers' rights advocates say it is illegal to threaten termination for a Social Security no-match letter. Workers have also filed a lawsuit for back pay owed to them under Measure C, which could cost the hotel tens of thousands of dollars. Maria Martinez has been cleaning hotel rooms at Woodfin Suites for 6 years, since the hotel opened. She says the hotel has refused to show her and city council members the letter from Social Security.
They asked me for my Social Security number, and I asked the manager for the letter that they that said that they needed it, and they stopped asking. What they gave us instead was a letter from the Woodfin, with Woodfin letterhead.
These are the letters that they gave to the workers? That supposedly is from Social Security Administration.
Yeah. Woodfin Hotel workers were not alone standing out in the rain for their rights. Emeryville City Council member John Fricke stood with protesters in support of the city's Measure C and workers' rights. State Senate President Don Parada, Assembly members Lonnie Hancock and Wilma Chan have also urged Woodfin Suites Hotel to settle the matter. A litigation judge will hear the workers' lawsuit on November 30th. For FSRN in Emeryville, I'm Christina Onnestad.
In Washington State, Democrat Darcy Berner has confirmed she's conceding the race against Republican Congressman Dave Reichert. At a news conference today in Bellevue, Berner says the voters of the 8th District have spoken. She left without answering any questions. Berner called Reichert last night to congratulate him on a second term. It's the second straight close victory for Reichert, who is a former King County sheriff. He'll represent the suburban Seattle district for another 2 years.
Washington Governor Christine Gregoire is asking the Department of Homeland Security to authorize a three-month project for scanning driver's licenses at the border with British Columbia. Gregoire hopes the successful display of technology will persuade the government that passports won't be needed for all border crossings starting in summer of 2009. She and British Columbia Premier Gordon Campbell are trying to streamline the crossings as the region prepares for the 2010 Winter Olympics in Vancouver, B.C. The proposal is to use handheld scanners at the main Blaine crossings and possibly at Port Angeles. The devices can scan the barcode on the back of U.S. and Canadian driver's licenses to check for fake licenses and to see if the name is on a security watch list of either country.
A federal appeals court panel in Seattle was to hear arguments today about the 22-year sentence given to terrorist Ahmed Rassam, who was convicted of trying to bomb the Los Angeles airport. Defense lawyers say the term should be reduced by 10 years. U.S. attorneys say it should be longer. Rassam was caught with explosives in 1999 in Port Angeles. Rassam's lawyers believe that one of the nine counts he was convicted of should be thrown out. The U.S. Attorney's Office wanted a 35-year term. It is suggested that the sentence imposed last year by federal judge John Kugenor may have been colored by a distaste for the Bush administration's treatment of enemy combatants. In their appeal, prosecutors cited Kugenor, saying that Rassam's case illustrated that U.S. courts are capable of handling terrorism cases.
Throughout Florida's 13th congressional district, a recount continues to determine the winner of the race to replace Catherine Harris in Congress. Mitch Perry reports.
Election officials say the complete recount between Republican Vern Buchanan and Democrat Christine Jennings won't be complete until the end of this week. As of late yesterday afternoon, Buchanan had a 377-vote lead over Jennings, a margin of less than 0.2%. Provisional ballots in Sarasota County were to be counted today, which could aid Jennings. However, the controversy in this election stems from the 18,382 ballots cast in Sarasota County, 13% of the total, that bore no votes in the congressional race. Election rights activists and the Jennings campaign say they have received hundreds of calls and emails from voters claiming either the race did not appear on their ballot or the summary screen on the electronic voting machines they use showed their vote for Jennings did not register correctly. On Monday night, the Jennings camp filed a lawsuit to protect the county's election material from tampering or destruction. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
Washington Senator Patty Murray has won a leadership position in the new Democratic majority in the Senate. Murray will be Secretary of the Democratic Caucus. That's the fourth-ranking post in the Senate hierarchy, behind Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, Assistant Majority Leader Dick Durbin, and Vice Chairman Charles Schumer. Murray, in her third term, notes she is the only woman among the four Democratic leaders. She has pledged to work to help young people go to college, make prescription drugs more affordable under Medicare, and work for services for veterans, especially those who served in Iraq and Afghanistan. When Congress convenes in January, Murray also is expected to head an appropriations subcommittee controlling billions of dollars in transportation spending. The move up to a move up to a senior post on the Veterans Affairs Committee.
Senator Barbara Boxer on Thursday promised major policy shifts in global warming, air quality, and toxic waste cleanup as she prepared to take the lead in the U.S. Senate's Environmental Committee. Boxer's elevation to chairwoman of the Senate Environmental Public Works Committee marks a dramatic shift in ideology for the panel. The California Democrat replaces Republican James Inhofe, who blocked bills seeking to cut greenhouse gases contributing to global warming, calling the issue a hoax. Boxer says she intends to introduce legislation to curb greenhouse gases, strengthen environmental laws regarding public health, and hold oversight hearings on federal Superfund cleanups. On global warming, Boxer said she would model federal legislation after a new California law that imposed the first statewide limit on greenhouse gases.
Senate Democrats chose party leaders today for their first session in 12 years as the congressional majority. Their choice as majority leader, Senator Harry Reid, said a top priority is getting a new Secretary of Defense confirmed. Reid says he supports replacing Donald Rumsfeld with former CIA Director Robert Gates by year's end. Senate Democrats also appointed former U.S. Capitol Police Chief Terrence Gaynor as Sergeant-at-Arms. Gaynor retired April 6th after being criticized for hiring his son-in-law as a police officer. When the 110th Congress convenes in January, Senator Richard Durbin of Illinois will be Reid's deputy as the vote-counting majority whip. Senator Charles Schumer will continue serving as campaign committee chairman and also will assume the title of vice chairman of the Democratic Caucus.
Flawed government policies and negative stereotyping of minority men have limited their economic opportunities, a new study says. The study urges improved health care and education for minorities and less media consolidation. The study by the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies examined the impact of U.S. policies of men of black, Hispanic, Asian, and Native American descent. Among other recommendations, the report calls on the government to increase the minimum wage and to re-examine sentencing requirements for nonviolent offenders.
Voters in Michigan approved a ballot measure to amend the state's constitution to ban affirmative action in the public sector last week. It was just one in a series of measures voters approved nationwide that critics see as a setback to racial justice. FSRN's Aaron Glantz reports.
The main mover and shaker behind Michigan's ban on affirmative action was Ward Connerly, a former University of California regent who rose to prominence 10 years ago when he led a successful campaign to eliminate affirmative action in California. In the closing days of the campaign, Connerly, who is black, proudly accepted the Ku Klux Klan's endorsement of the initiative.
If the Ku Klux Klan thinks that equality is right, God bless them. Thank them for finally reaching the point where logic and reason are being applied instead of hate.
Proponents of affirmative action are going to court to stop implementation of the initiative. The racial justice group By Any Means Necessary filed suit, saying states cannot preempt federal anti-discrimination laws. Such claims were tried and ultimately failed when the Supreme Court declined to hear a similar case against Prop 209, California's precursor to Michigan's Measure 2. David Waymire is a spokesperson for One United Michigan, a coalition of more than 200 organizations, including the League of Women Voters, the Catholic Church, and the AARP.
Well, we've had some chance to talk with Bob Laird, who is a former director of admissions at University of California, Berkeley. And he has painted a pretty stark picture of what's happened at UC Berkeley and at UCLA, both in terms of the students who are there, the academic possibilities, and the problems that lack of diversity causes the entire academic operation there. And we're very concerned that those very same problems will be imported right here to Michigan.
Waymire takes heart that the head of the University of Michigan, Mary Sue Coleman, continues to speak out for diversity on campus.
I will not allow our university to go down the path to mediocrity. That is not Michigan.
Mary Sue Coleman, the morning after Michigan voters banned affirmative action, she asked the university's lawyers to examine every possible avenue to continue diversity programs.
Diversity makes us strong, and it's too critical to our mission, too critical to our excellence, too critical to our future, simply to abandon.
Anti-immigrant measures also did well at the ballot this election year. Voters in Arizona passed initiatives barring undocumented immigrants from going free on bail, barring undocumented immigrants from receiving state-sponsored education or child care, barring undocumented immigrants from receiving punitive damages in lawsuits, and making English the state's official language. Voters in Colorado also approved two anti-immigrant measures. Mariana Bustamante is education director of the American Civil Liberties Union's Immigrant Rights Project. She says immigrant voters will have a stronger voice in 2008 after Latinos who mobilized against H.R. 4437, the harsh immigrant rights bill passed in the House, complete the process of becoming citizens.
I think in the long run, we are going to see an effect because it was close to 3 million people that marched in the spring of 2006. And all of those people were, you know, the majority, it was the first time they ever participated in something like that, in a social mobilization of that magnitude. And that those people, it's going to influence the way they vote and their level of civic participation for the rest of their lives, including a lot of children that participated. So those effects we're going to see in the long term, and the effects already we're seeing in terms of their alienation from the Republican Party. You know, about 70% of Latinos voted for Democrats as opposed to previous elections where it was closely, you know, more close to 50-50. So we are seeing the effects of H.R. 4437 in terms of long-term voting participation.
Arizona did give some good news to immigrant rights activists. Two congressional candidates most allied with the Minutemen vigilantes both went down to defeat, helping increase the Democratic majority in Congress. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz.
Stay tuned for Out Loud following our newscast. And at 7, it's Amanda's Jam Corner. In the weather, if you didn't get enough clouds and rain last week, there'll be another week of the same in the Willamette Valley and Columbia Gorge, with highs in the low 50s. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Jesus F. Palacios was arrested last month after... Jesus F. Palacios was arrested last month after sheriff's deputies spotted him trying to jimmy a car door. Using newly acquired access to federal immigration files, they scanned his fingerprints into a database at the police station and instantly determined the 30-year-old Mexican was a previously deported illegal immigrant with a criminal record. The Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department and nearly 50 other Southern California police and law enforcement agencies have been given rapid access to federal records on criminal immigrants. So have the police in Boston and Dallas. The U.S. government intends to make information available to all local law enforcement agencies in the nation within 2 years. Civil rights advocates say enlisting local authorities could chill relations in communities where police rely on immigrants to come forward without fearing their own status will be checked.
A talking Jesus doll has been turned down by the Marine Reserve's Toys for Tots program. A suburban Los Angeles company offered to donate 4,000 of the foot-tall dolls, which quote Bible verses, for distribution to needy children this holiday season. The battery-powered Jesus is one of several dolls based on biblical figures and manufactured by One to Believe, a division of the Valencia-based Beverly Hills Teddy Bear Company.
Some $15 million in international aid for improving the safety of nuclear power plants in the former Soviet Union has been diverted. Shell companies in the United States are used to launder as much as $36 billion from former Soviet republics. Millions in taxable income are hidden in bank accounts in the Caribbean. All because congressional investigators say U.S. states grant incorporation to nearly 2 million new companies a year without identifying their owners. Lenience which allows people to hide their identities and shell companies to launder money, evade taxes, and finance illegal activities. A report by the Government Accountability Office, Congress's investigative arm, found that none of the 50 states customarily requires disclosure of the owners of companies which are not publicly traded. Other countries do require ownership information to be provided, lawmakers say. The Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee is examining this issue.
A Nevada woman, Roberta Stewart, is going to federal court in her ongoing battle with the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs over attempts to honor her late husband's Wiccan faith. Roberta Stewart joins the Americans United for Separation of Church and State in filing the suit today over the VA's refusal to include the Wiccan symbol on its official list of emblems for government headstones and markers. Stewart's husband, Sergeant Patrick Stewart, was killed last September when his helicopter was shot down in Afghanistan. Veterans officials for the state have approved the use of Wiccan pentacle at a national cemetery in Nevada on the basis they have jurisdiction over the burial ground. But Stewart says she is pressing ahead with the lawsuit to make sure followers of the Wiccan faith everywhere are not discriminated against. The VA has approved more than 30 symbols for headstones, including one for atheists, but so far, none for Wiccans.
Joint congressional committees will be working to reconcile differences in their versions of the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act that the House passed yesterday. The National Lawyers Guild has taken a strong stand in opposition to the act, saying it is a violation of civil rights. Martha Odom interviews Alejandro Queral of the Northwest Constitutional Rights Center in Portland.
This is Martha Odom for KBOO Radio. I am with Alejandro Queral from the Northwest Constitutional Rights Center, and I'm looking at the Senate bill called the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act that was unanimously passed in the Senate at the end of September and will now go to the House. It states that in any animal enterprise, actions causing a profit loss, even if it's a peaceful protest, a boycott, a media campaign, or leafleting, would be labeled terrorism, and there is sufficient reason to be definitely outraged by this. Alejandro, would you give us a comment on this, please?
Absolutely. So the Animal Anti-Predatorism Act is actually, unfortunately, much closer to being a reality than we'd like, because it actually passed the House of Representatives yesterday with little debate or discussion, which means it's now going to go what it's called into conference resolution on that. It'll go to the floors of both chambers for another vote. I think it's very important to recognize that this is a bill that actually does incredible amount of damage to protected under the First Amendment. As you mentioned, there's a potential there that any kind of loss of profit caused intentionally by an action, for example, anything that causes or potentially causes a loss of profit could result in jail time. If the loss of profit is less than $10,000, for example, you could be facing up to a year in jail. If the loss of profit cost is over $100,000, the sentence may be up to 10 years in jail without necessarily causing any kind of harm to life, human life, or otherwise. And so basically this bill is criminalizing what are now legitimate activities against corporations that use animals for profit. And obviously this is very of great concern, because it could have a significant chilling effect on, particularly on animal rights.
The labeling of terrorist also brings the specter of detention without rights of any sort.
Well, there's always that potential, and obviously it's the potential that they could be detained as such, or they could be even just having to face a smudge of the label terrorist. It's not only, obviously, the criminal impact, the criminal implications of the bill, but also the impact that it's going to have on civil society. And what's also very worrisome, in addition to this, is that the label terrorism and the potential criminal implications may arise simply, or if you conspire with someone else, could give rise to charges against you under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act.
Since it's going to joint committee, is there any chance of this actually being defeated?
Well, there is a potential that it could be defeated. It's very important that people may contact their members of Congress so that when the reconciled bills go to the respective chambers, we can defeat it. We have to take action now. We have to contact our members of Congress, both in the Senate and the House.
I thank you so much. Alejandro Corral from the Northwest Constitutional Rights Center, speaking on the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act.
The Los Angeles Police Department has investigated an arrest caught on videotape in which an officer used pepper spray on a transient after he had been handcuffed and shoved into a patrol car. The latest video was shot by a resident of Venice Beach, who turned it over to the transient's attorney, who then provided it to the LA Times. The incident occurred last year, and the officer who used the pepper spray resigned before the investigation was completed. The Times said the officer told investigators he used the pepper spray after the transient spit on him once and tried to spit on him again. The report of the pepper spray videotape comes on the heels of another tape showing a police officer hitting a man in the face several times following a foot chase in Hollywood. Both the department and the FBI are investigating that incident.
A Cuban-American activist was sentenced today to nearly 4 years in prison for hiding weapons in what prosecutors said was an attempt to overthrow the Cuban government. U.S. District Judge James Cohn imposed a 46-month term on wealthy developer Santiago Alvarez, a key beneficiary of jailed Cuban militant Luis Posada Corrales. Alvarez was charged with conspiring to possess arms, including machine guns and a grenade launcher. Osvaldo Mitat, an Alvarez employee, was sentenced to 37 months on the same count. Alvarez is a longtime associate of Posada, a former CIA operative accused by Cuba and Venezuela of masterminding the 1976 bombing of a Cuban airliner, which killed 73 people. A judge has ruled that Posada, in custody in Texas, must be deported to a country other than those two, but the U.S. cannot find one willing to take him.
The nation's Roman Catholic bishops approved new guidelines today to support gay parishioners while affirming the church stance that same-sex relationships are, quote, disordered. Gay Catholic activists immediately judged the document a failure, which will push gays and lesbians away from the church. In the statement, quote, "Ministry to persons with a homosexual inclination upholds the Catholic prohibition against same-sex marriage and gay adoption." Several bishops said Monday that Catholics who ignore church teaching, including gays who are sexually active, should not take communion.
Seven French airport workers are appealing a decision that upheld the withdrawal of security clearance that allows them to work at Paris's main airport. They are among 72 Roissy airport workers who have lost security clearance. Their workers claim they're the victims of an anti-Muslim witch hunt and hysteria about supposed terrorist threats. Tony Cross has the story from Paris.
The small courtroom in the Paris suburb of Cergy was packed last Friday. As well as the seven plaintiffs and their legal team of five, dozens of reporters and trade unionists turned out to hear the lawyers' debate. At the beginning of the month, local officials revealed that 72 security badges have been taken away from employees of firms which work inside the security zone at the airport. The badge holders were all accused of associating with groups that were judged to be potentially terrorist. About 10 were apparently Sri Lankan Tamils, one a Sikh, all the rest are Muslims. Karim Kerfouche has now lost his job with courier company Chronopost after having security clearance for 10 years. He wears a long beard as a sign of his faith and during the inquiry was questioned about his visits to Mecca, Pakistan and India, which he says were all several years ago.
People shouldn't give way to hysteria and make unjustified associations just because you're a Muslim or North African or because you can be seen to be Muslim because of your beard or something like that. They can't take arbitrary, unjustified decisions because they have their doubts. There has to be some basis for the doubts. Otherwise, they can have doubts about anybody, any Muslim, and then injustices take place.
The authorities contend that there are 87,000 security badges, so taking away 72 is not a lot. And they point out that a high proportion of airport workers are Muslim and claim that there has been no discrimination on the basis of religion. They say clearance was lifted as a result of reports from an anti-terrorist cell of the French Secret Services. But when the workers were interviewed about their cases, they weren't informed of the alleged evidence against them. Before Friday's case, the lawyers won access to the reports on their clients. They were anonymous, short, and vague. Workers were declared vulnerable to terrorist ideology because they knew someone who knows someone judged to be an Islamic fundamentalist, because they'd visited certain countries, or because they were said to have attended certain mosques. Mohamed Siddiqui found that his name was misspelled, his address was wrong, and that his nationality was given as Algerian, although he is French. And he didn't even know there was an inquiry into him because he was summoned to be interviewed while he was on vacation in Algeria.
If they claim they've made an in-depth inquiry of 18 months, how come they didn't know that I was on holiday from August 4th to September 6th? I never even touched their registered letter, and it was returned to them. But then they made their decision. I present a danger to the airport.
Last week, two of the 72 were given back their security badges. They were among a group of eight who took a separate legal action against local officials and Interior Minister Nicolas Sarkozy, demanding their right to presumption of innocence and to know the cases against them. The court refused to hear the cases. The trade unions feel there is a link to Sarkozy and his use of right-wing anti-terror rhetoric as part of his campaign to be elected President of France next year. They point to a book published in April by Philippe de Villiers, the leader of the far-right nationalist party Mouvement pour la France. De Villiers claimed that Islamists had infiltrated the airport and set up unofficial places of worship. Sarkozy, who makes no secret of his wish to win hard-right votes, responded by declaring that the prayer rooms were to be closed and later defended the security clampdown as a precautionary measure. Meanwhile, Karim Kerfouche's mother, Zahra, pleads that her family is victim of a cruel injustice.
This really gets to me. It hurts me that they attack us like this when we've done nothing.
My son lost his job, and he has a little boy, and he has no work because he's a Muslim. I just don't know. I'm just shocked.
Whether they're victims of paranoia or precaution, the 72 Rwasi workers are out of work and at the center of another row about what rights should be sacrificed for the sake of security and Europe's relationship with its Muslim minority. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Paris.
In Nigeria, oil giant ExxonMobil, as well as some members of its board of directors, have been charged with tax evasion. Sam Ulukoya reports from Lagos.
ExxonMobil and five of its directors are facing a three-count charge of evading $31 million in taxes in Akwa Ibom State in Nigeria's Niger Delta region. ExxonMobil, which has the second largest oil operations in Nigeria, does most of its business in the state. The state government said the huge tax evasion was uncovered in a painstaking investigation by the state Internal Revenue Service. Although ExxonMobil denied the charges, an official of the Revenue Service said in an effort to evade tax, the company has for several years been concealing most of the taxable allowances being paid to its local and expatriate employees by not reflecting them in its payroll. This is the latest accusation of tax evasion against a Western oil company in Nigeria. In August, Nigeria's lower house of Congress released a report that showed that the American company Chevron overstated the cost of its operations in order to evade taxes. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
South African lawmakers passed legislation recognizing gay marriages today, despite criticism from both traditionalists and gay activists. The bill, unprecedented on a continent where homosexuality is taboo, was decried by gay activists for not going far enough and by opponents who warned it was, quote, provoking God's anger, end quote. Veterans of the government of the governing African National Congress praise the civil union bill for extending basic freedoms to everyone under the spirit of the country's first post-apartheid constitution, adopted a decade ago by framers determined to make discrimination a thing of the past. South Africa's constitution was the first in the world to prohibit discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, providing a powerful legal tool to gay rights activists, even though South Africa remains conservative on such issues.
The United Nations said today that China has made progress in increasing access to water for its citizens, but still faces serious challenges in fighting pollution. Despite a growing concern for environmental issues, heavy polluters continue to foul the water and air due to poor enforcement of restrictions on the local level. The government is building a $60 billion network of canals to move vast amounts of water from China's wetter south to Beijing and other parts of the arid north. Zhao Huaidong, director of the Ministry of Water Resources Water Environment Assessment Center, said the government was aware of the urgent needs to address pollution as well. In August, the government said it would spend $125 billion to improve water treatment and recycling by 2010 to fight the mounting threat of urban water pollution.
India and Pakistan resumed peace talks today for the first time since the July 11th serial bombings of Mumbai's train network. Binu Alex has more.
A joint terrorism panel is on top of the agenda in the resumed peace process between India and Pakistan. In the never-ending blame games with deep mistrust on both sides, India claims Pakistan has not done enough to restrain anti-India militants based in Pakistan. India has even accused its neighbor of having a role in the Mumbai train bombings that killed 207 people in July. Meanwhile, Islamabad says separatist violence can only end once India resolves the dispute over Kashmir. International pressure, especially from the United States, is said to be the main reason for the two-day talks between Indian Foreign Secretary Shiv Shankar Menon and his Pakistani counterpart Riaz Muhammad Khan. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Binu Alex.
Mexico's Congress has passed a resolution which calls on the U.S. Congress to suspend the deportation of the mother of a 7-year-old boy and any other illegal immigrant parents of U.S. citizens. The lawmakers are backing second grader Sal Arellano, a U.S. citizen who appeared before them to plead for help. He's trying to stop the U.S. from deporting his mother, who has taken refuge in a Chicago church. One lawmaker says that if the U.S. agrees, it would, quote, create a precedent that will benefit more than 4.9 million children whose parents live under the threat of deportation, end quote. U.S. officials say there is no right to sanctuary in a church under U.S. law, but they have not yet moved to seize the boy's mother.
11 people are reported dead after suspected paramilitary attacks in a local community in the Montes Azules region of Chiapas, Mexico. Luz Ruiz reports.
Social and non-governmental organizations are calling yesterday's attack a massacre. Supposed paramilitaries killed a total of 11 people, among them an 8-year-old boy and a newborn baby, according to a handwritten report distributed by a Zapatista community in the region. An official report from the state prosecutor's office has recognized only 2 deaths and 2 injuries. The attack comes after several incidents that had been escalating in intensity and aggression, resulting from land disputes between communities in the area. Conflicts over land in the Lacandon jungle, which in 1972 was officially declared a bioreserve, have been taking place for decades as the Lacandon people were given control over this natural preserve and all other indigenous groups were pushed to resettle to other areas. Reports by non-governmental and human rights organizations working in the Montes Azules rainforest had been warning state and federal authorities about possible violent evictions, harassments, and aggressions to indigenous communities in the area. Authorities failed to act on the warnings. The area is also a battleground for economic interest in wood exploitation, water, and other natural resources. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Luz Ruiz in Chiapas, Mexico.
Under a recent U.S. Department of Education decision, Oregon will not be allowed to change the way its schools are rated under the federal No Child Left Behind Act. The state was hoping to be chosen for a pilot project that would let schools be rated according to the progress each student makes rather than the percentage of students who pass the state's academic tests. The pilot program is called a growth model because it measures how much knowledge students have gained. Oregon applied in February to be one of a handful of pilot states, but its proposal was turned down. The state resubmitted its proposal in the spring, and Pat Burke, chief policy officer for the Oregon Department of Education, said the state addressed all the questions the federal department had raised about the first draft.
And that's the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 14th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. And that goes for news tips as well. Call us with your news tips at 503-231-8032, extension 203. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM, on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. My name's Mike Monkbold, and I'm your producer and audio editor for tonight's newscast. Our wire editors, are Dwayne Ponce and Helen Honey. Special thanks to reporter Martha Odom. Our engineer is Judy Feistel. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. And I'm Mike Monkbold.
And I'm Isaac Kaplan-Wolner. Coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., please join us for the KBOO Morning News. And at 7:30, Barbara Bernstein will host Locus Focus Talk Radio. Her guest is Alexa Riley, talking about her project to bring artists together in celebration of Salmon Nation. At 9, it's Veterans Voice with Northwest Vets for Peace. At 10, hear an interview with Omoyele Sowore, one of Nigeria's most prominent activists. He's been imprisoned 8 times and tortured for promoting democracy. He'll speak about the human impact of corporate oil interests in Nigeria. At 10:30, Martha Odom interviews local activists from Lewis and Clark College who recently formed a chapter of Students for a Democratic Society. At 11, it's Democracy Now! And at noon on Alternative Radio, the speaker is activist and author Antonio Juarez, speaking on oligarchy. That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Please volunteer with our humble broadcast by calling 503-231-8032, extension 203. As always, thanks so much for joining us.
It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Out Loud after a couple of station announcements.
KBOO Community Radio is looking for a full-time evening news and public affairs director. We're looking for someone with news and public affairs skills, writing, editing, production, and training experience in working with volunteers. The job requires the ability to work under deadlines, to work under pressure, and to work evening hours. The ability to work with a wide variety of people in a multicultural and cooperative environment is essential. For more information and to get a job application, please contact Chris Merrick, care of News Director Hiring Committee at KBOO, or go online at www.kboo.fm for an online job description. KBOO is an equal employment opportunity employer. Deadline is Friday, November the 17th at 5 p.m.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair-accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
This KBOO program has also been made possible by Portland's gay and lesbian community Yellow Pages, providing a wide array of gay-friendly business listings. More information at 503-230-7701 or www.pdxgayyellowpages.com. And, in other words, women's books and resources, serving you from its new location at 8 Northeast Killingsworth at Williams. In other words, is your local nonprofit feminist bookstore and resource center, offering community space, gifts, tools for the revolution, women's writings, and much more. 503-232-6003 or inotherwords.org.
Good evening and welcome to the Out Loud Show. This is KBOO's Queer News and Public Affairs Show. The Out Loud is produced by the Queer Boo Collective, and we are always recruiting volunteers to help create the show. You can contact us at by email at kbooutloud@yahoo.com. You can also use that email address to send us your announcements and event listings, or if you have any questions or maybe even comments on our show. Again, our email is kbooutloud@yahoo.com. My name is Carla, and our guests tonight are local musician Joni Lawrence, and we also have Natalia Kay with us, who is the executive director and co-producer of Siren Nation. But first, I'd like to talk with Joni a little bit about her music. So welcome to the Out Loud Show, Joni.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, we were listening to, for those of us that were listening just a few minutes ago, the opening music was one of Joni's tunes, titled Just a Movie. And how old, I guess, is that a current song? Or tell us a little bit
it
about
is.
What we just heard.
Yeah, well, I'm a fairly new resident to Portland. I moved here in May, and I've been here about 6 months now. And I came from Champaign, Illinois. And back in Champaign, I was a full-time musician, decided that pursuing that career in a bigger city, in a perhaps a bit more hip place than Central Illinois, might be a good thing. But I have great fans back there in Champaign, and that record is my fourth album. It's a live recording made with my hometown fans in Champaign, and it was just released here in Portland in July. And that's one of the tunes off of it.
So, again, the song we heard was called Just a Movie. And what was the name of the CD that was from?
The CD is called With No Apology.
Where is that available locally?
Let's see. That's a good question. Where is it available locally? Well, it's available at my shows. So if you come out to some shows, you'll definitely be able to purchase it. I'm thinking it's available somewhere else locally, but I can't remember where at the moment. But
sorry to put you on the
spot.
No,
that's probably something I should have on the tip of my tongue. Also, of course, it's available online. I have a website, JoniLawrence.com, and Lawrence is with a U, so it's JoniLaurence.com. And you can also purchase CDs through CD Baby, which is housed right here in Portland.
Excellent. Okay. So how often do you play locally? I guess, or tell me what's coming up in the future for you.
The answer to both those questions, in terms of how frequently I play, that varies. I've been doing quite a lot of playing lately. I just got back a few weeks ago from a Midwest tour where I was there for about 3 weeks. And then since I've been back, I've done a couple shows a week. And I'm going to start kind of bringing that down a little bit for the winter season, just to rest my vocals and try to take in some more things instead of putting so much out, you know, kind of rest, that sort of thing. But I do have a show tomorrow night, which is one of the reasons I wanted to come on the show tonight and tell you and all your listeners. I'll be performing with a couple of local musicians that I met recently here in Portland, and it's been great. It's a great music city. I'm sure you already know that, but since I've been here, I've seen some fabulous musicians, fabulous artists, and had the pleasure to become friends with a couple. And we're going to put on a show tomorrow night. It's called Light in the Dark. And basically, it's myself, Juliet Wires, and a man named Lincoln Crockett. And we're all singer-songwriters. It's going to be kind of an inspiring night where we'll sing songs that make you laugh, sing songs that make you cry, sing songs that make you think. It's about just finding some hope in the despair, light in the dark sort of thing. And that will be at the White Eagle, which is at 836 North Russell in Portland. And it will start at 8:30, and we'll be playing all the way until 1 a.m., so if you've got something else going on that night, don't worry. Just finish that up and come on out. I'm sure we'll still be there at the White Eagle.
Excellent. Okay. And I think you're going to play a song for us.
I am. I'd love to.
Tell us a little bit about what we're going to hear.
This song is called Breathing, and I actually put this on my third record, too, which is entitled Trash Bag Birdie. I think you'll hear the title cut off of that in a few minutes. And this is just a song that I've had a lot of positive response to. I've personally gained a lot from singing it. Every time I sing it, I'm affected by it, and I hope that others are as well. And I liked it so much that I actually also put it on my live album with No Apology and a different sort of arrangement, but still good, I hope. This is called Breathing. Far away, spiraling down in darkness away from a light of day. I know what it's like to feel the warm sun on the first day of spring flooding into my bones. And I see you there, holding it in, holding it together.
Let it out, let it in. Let it out, let it in. It's like breathing. Let it out, let it in. Let it out, let it in. It's like breathing, breathing. I know what it's like to feel all alone in the company of family, a stranger in my home. I know what it's like to feel lifted inside by the strum of a guitar, a voice that makes me cry. And I see you there, holding it in, holding it together. Let it out, let it in. Let it out, let it in. It's like breathing. Let it out, let it in. Let it out, let it in. It's like breathing, breathing. And there's a moment in a deep exhale. The soul is free to fly. Love coming to me, a fluttering starts in my chest and goes down to my belly, and I am standing here, holding it in, holding it together. Let it out, let it in, let it out, let it in, it's like breathing. Like breathing, breathing, breathing. Let it out, let it in. Let it out, let it in. It's like breathing, breathing, breathing. Let it out, let it in. Let it out, let it in. It's like breathing, 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 breathing.
That was great. That was breathing, and we're talking with and listening to Joni Lawrence. And just to repeat, if people want to hear more, Joni's playing tomorrow at the White Eagle at 8:30. So tell us more a little bit about the history of you and your guitar. So how did you get playing, or what brought you to where you are today?
The Indigo Girls. Way back when, I actually didn't start playing guitar until I was a senior in college. I was a bit of a shy person in my young adulthood, and I didn't really sing in front of people and that sort of thing. But I just, you know, I heard of the Indigo Girls, and I saw these women playing these guitars and making some great harmony, and thought, gee, I want to do that. And I got some books from a library, and taught myself to play the guitar, at least a few chords. And then I met some women in Champaign when I moved there, and we started a band called Girlfriends, and we all played the same guitar part and sang the same melody part. But we had such great support from the women in the community that we just kept singing, and eventually we break out into a harmony note here and there, and eventually break out into a new instrument here and there. And within a few years, we had a real official and legitimate sort of band. And I played in a band for a number of years and then went solo. So that's the path.
And here we are.
Here we are in Portland, yeah.
Yay.
Amazing.
And it's good to hear. It sounds like the musical community here has been real welcoming and supportive.
I think so, yeah. You know, it's a lot of work to really put yourself out there and meet a lot of people, but it's definitely worth it. And I've just found that Portland as a whole is just a very welcoming and warm community, just for anybody, I think. It's probably why everybody's moving here. It's like, okay, stop moving here now. I heard 70 people a day are moving to Portland.
That applies to you. That applies to me. Does that apply to you? Are you native?
When's the cutoff? No, I'm not native.
Oh, okay. Yeah. We're all from somewhere else. Yeah. Okay. Well, Joni, tell us, what can we expect at the show tomorrow night? I guess there's going to be two other people playing with you.
There will be.
Is everybody playing guitar or anything else?
Well, let's see. Juliet Wires is a local artist. I think she grew up here, actually. And are you familiar with her name at all?
The name rings a bell, but...
Yeah, she's very good. She's, I guess, done some performing in the community, but also done a lot of national touring. And I hooked up with her. I first met her in New York a couple of years ago when I was at a music conference there. And when I moved here, I looked her up, and we started hanging out a bit. And then Lincoln Crockett, and Juliet plays guitar and sings original tunes. I met Lincoln when he was performing with his band called Cross-Eyed Rosie. They're really great. They just had a great CD release party the other night, packed full of people and really raucous. It was a lot of fun. And Lincoln both plays guitar and mandolin and writes songs. So, you know, this is a new thing for us, this light in the dark kind of format. And what we hope to do is the first part of the night, when people who have day jobs and might want to go to bed at a reasonable hour, if they come out for the show, and I hope they do, we'll do kind of a short set format for the first couple of hours. So we'll each do maybe a 35-minute set, short breaks in between, and then take a longer break about 10:30. And then from 11 to 1, it's kind of anything goes. We might do a songwriter in the round sort of thing, might have a few short sets. But it's going to be just more fluid there, so that people that walk in hopefully get to see a little bit of everybody.
Nice. And is that kind of with other musicians, is that kind of how your shows usually are? Are you usually
most
solo?
Most of my shows have been solo here. Mm-hmm. I've done a handful of shows since I moved to town. I had a CD release party I mentioned back in July, and then I've performed a few other places in town. And just because I haven't met that many people yet, I haven't had the opportunity to hook up with them. So I hope that I do more of that in the future. I'd love to meet other singer-songwriters as well as just other players, people mm-hmm. that want to hang out and jam and that sort of thing.
And I'm thinking all your contact information is on your website.
It is, yes, okay. Which is JoniLawrence.com, Lawrence with a U, JoniLaurence.com.
So we were going to play another short piece off of a CD, but we have a couple minutes yet. Do you want to play another short song?
Sure.
Okay. What's this one going to be?
Well, let's see. I didn't get a pick out, but I'll just use my fingers. Well, a short one would qualify for that. I'll play this one. This song is called My Lost Confidence, and not too long after I started touring full-time, I had a show where I played to three people and got a little worried that I quit my day job and wrote a song about getting my confidence back. Okay. Found my keys, now I've lost my confidence. It was just here a few minutes ago. Checked my pockets in the car, it surely hasn't gone too far. Maybe a cat batted it under the stove. I found my keys to drive away, but lost my confidence. It's what keeps me steady on the road. Check the closet under the bed and the space inside my head. I really need to find it before I go. Well, here it is. I found
you found the end, who you are. Lesson I've learned from my lost confidence is not to underestimate a word or two of encouragement and hope during the time it's needed most. Just say, keep on doing what you do. Just say, keep on doing what you do.
That was Joni Lawrence. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm, my pleasure.
The name of that one was?
That was My Lost Confidence.
Okay. And for folks that want to hear more, Joni's playing tomorrow night at the White Eagle starting at 8:30. Or if you want more information about her, upcoming shows, contact information, her website, JoniLawrence.com, spelled JoniLawrence.com. So thank you so much for coming on the
show. Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. And now next, our next guest that we're going to talk to is Natalia Kay. And hello, Natalia.
Hi, Carla.
Welcome to the Out Loud Show.
Thanks for having me.
And I announced your title earlier as the executive director and co-producer of Siren Nation.
Yeah.
So tell us, what's that about?
Well, Siren Nation is a women's music and art festival that will be coming to Portland next November. And it was conceived of with my business partner, Tamara J. Brown. We have a production company called Tough Titties Productions. And we decided that the best thing we could possibly do for Portland to celebrate how much we love it and how much great art there is here is to throw a women's music festival. It seemed strange that it didn't exist already. And we started talking to people and the response was so positive and people were so willing and ready to get on board and help make it happen that the ball just got rolling. We've been organizing, fundraising for over a year now already. And what else would you like to know about it?
Well, I guess I want to start off by letting people know there's a lot of information on the website. It's SirenNation.com.
Correct.
So there's some history, but, you know, mm-hmm. events and things and, you know, stuff that's going on is on the website.
Right.
Part of the fundraising, I guess the way that I found out about you was some of the events, some of the fundraising events that have uh-huh. been happening.
Yeah.
So tell us about, you know, what's coming up.
Well, this week on Thursday at the Baghdad, we are hosting a screening of a documentary called For the Love of Dolly. This is going to be our first film event that's been part of our fundraising, and film is ultimately going to be part of the festival as well. Then next month, on December 15th at Holocene, we're having a CD release party for a compilation called Voices from the Siren Nation that we have produced in collaboration with Sarah Duggar's label, Cherchez la Femme. And the compilation features 16 phenomenal women performers from Portland, from all different walks of the music scenes. And at the CD release, we will have performing Kaya Wilson from Team Dresch and the Butchies, Virginia Lopez from the Mambo Queens, Heather Perkins and the Swallows, as well as the mini bike dance troupe, the Sprockets.
Great, great. So I just want to make sure people know Thursday this week at 8 p.m. at the Baghdad. Tell us about the movie that's happening.
The movie is a documentary by a director named Ty Ullman, who's from New York City, about fans of Dolly Parton and kind of how their love of Dolly helps guide them through their lives. And it's definitely entertaining sometimes to see the lengths to which they take their fanaticism. But it's a very compassionate and compelling film, a lot of fun. And you can check out more about the movie at their website, www.fortheloveofdolly.com.
Okay, so that's happening Thursday night. And then it's Friday of next week.
Next month, December 15th.
December 15th.
We'll have our CD release party at Holocene.
Okay. And How can people, I guess, get involved or contribute? Or are you at that point where you want people to kind of step up for the Siren Nation?
Absolutely. We welcome involvement. We are particularly looking for people who are willing to commit to being involved until the festival happens in hopefully larger capacities. We're looking for grant writers. We're looking for people to help us find sponsorship. We're looking for folks with experience in marketing. I like to say the more the merrier, and especially when it comes to producing a festival, we need as much help as we can possibly get. You can reach me at info@sirennation.com and let me know what you're interested in doing and how you'd like to get involved. We welcome as much help as we can get.
Okay, great. So I want to say thanks so much to Natalia Kay for coming on the Out Loud show.
Thank you.
And thanks again to Joni Lawrence for sharing your music. And I'm going to go ahead and close the show. And the music that we're going to be closing with, Joni, tell us the song that we're closing with.
This is called Trash Bag Birdie. It's the title track off of my my third record called Trash Bag Birdie. And no. Oh. All right, we just had a little voice in our head that said that there's going to be a different song that's played last. So that song is called Just a Movie, and this is off of my brand new record. And it's a live record, and this is the last song that takes us out of the concert.
And so before we go to that song, I want to say thanks again to both of our guests. And you've been listening to The Out Loud Show, KBOO's queer news and public affairs show. We'll be back in a week. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay proud and live out loud.
Sitting on Lakeshore Drive, watching people rolling by. A romance movie's rolling in my mind. And I see you there, the wind is blowing through your hair. And I see the moon, it's shining down on you. Falling in love, falling in love, falling in love. It's been an hour or two, a nice restaurant, dinner with you. A filet mignon was a first for you. The movie's rolling in my mind as we drink a bottle of red wine. You tell me about the girl who rocks your world. Falling in love, falling in love, falling in love. Falling in love, falling in love. Like the movies. Just a few days ago, she was here with us on the road. And I tried to play it cool, not let my feelings show. From the back seat of that car ride, I could see the gleaming in your eyes. And your laughter, it rolled like dunes of sand when she held your hand. Falling in love, 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 like the movies. And then I cut to the last scene of my movie fantasy, where I am standing on a green lawn. When you see me, you see that you without me, you come rushing into my arms, rushing into my arms. Just a movie, it's just a movie in my mind. It's just a movie.
6:30. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, Prison Pipeline with Ruth Kovacs.
Billy Rose was a low rider. Billy Rose was a night fighter. Billy Rose knew trouble like the sound of his own name. Busted on a drunken charge, driving someone else's car. The local midnight sheriff's claim to fame. In an Arizona jail, there is some who tell the tale. A Billy fought the sergeant for some milk that he demanded. Knowing they'd remain the boss, knowing he would pay the cost, they saw he was severely reprimanded. Take me home. Come and lay, help us lay young Billy down. Lulu was a Mexican, the law calls an alien for coming across the border with a...
Good evening, everyone. This is Ruth Kovacs. I'm coming to you with Prison Pipeline tonight. Reggie Bob and I co-host this program. Tonight's my night. Next week, Reggie Bob will be here with you. I welcome you all. As you know, Prison Pipeline is a program that is an advocate for prison reform. I would hope that whether you have someone who's a loved one that's incarcerated or a neighbor or a friend or even a stranger, that you're among us who understand that prison reform is a vital part of our society right now. The things that are going on in our American prisons sometimes are outrageous. That some of the very prison wardens and guards who have committed atrocities in the U.S. prisons were the very men who went overseas to Iraq and were used for some of the terrible atrocities we've heard about. Of course, that's not to say that goes on in all prisons all the time anymore. It's just part of the hard road to look at prisons and constantly be watchdogs and constantly work towards reform and to advocate a good prison program. When a man is locked up, his life is not over. He's still a human being. He should be treated with humanity and dignity. And part of doing that includes a family that is strong and supporting, a family that visits him, a family that loves him, a family that writes to him. A system that rehabilitates him. It's not just a punishment institution, it's a rehabilitation institution. He should leave prison with skills or spirit to start a life again, because half of the people who are now in prisons, jails, and penitentiaries throughout the United States will be out. They're not all in there for life. They'll be your neighbors. They'll be your friends. They'll be your daughter's boyfriend. Just think about it and try to do what you can to support us in our prison reform. Tonight, we're going to have a program talking to Debbie on the telephone. Now, Debbie was on a few months ago because her brother is incarcerated. And Debbie told me her story, and that led to me meeting her mother. So tonight, I'm going to talk to Debbie and let Debbie tell me about her mother. Can I talk to Debbie now? Hello, Debbie.
Hi, Ruth.
How you doing?
I'm doing fine.
I'm so glad you're going to help me out. Your mother talked to me at length on the phone and in a meeting recently, and she just wasn't able to connect with the same time that I could do the program. And she said, well, Debbie knows all about this. Why don't you just talk to her? And I said, that's a great idea, because I know you'll be a good guest, and you'll kind of tell us what the whole family's doing. So tell us the story about your mother. What was she like before your brother was accused of a felony and locked up and incarcerated?
I guess as far as the judicial system is concerned, we were brought up basically believing kind of the truth, justice, and American way. That's how our parents brought us up to believe, and that's what they believed. They just kind of went along, I guess, naively, thinking that if you do the right thing and tell the truth and, you know, even if something happens, you go through the system and you'll be fairly represented and things will work out for you.
And how many times had you heard that phrase, innocent until proven guilty?
All my life.
And how many times did you think that everyone who was in prison must be guilty and must be bad and therefore doesn't deserve much? Did your mother kind of go along with that?
I would go along with that. You see people every single night on the news going in front of the court system, and I guess we probably just sat there and watched and thought that, well, they must have done something wrong to deserve that.
So this vicious, evil person deserves whatever happens in prison, right?
Right.
Well, I don't know that I ever quite went through that, but I do know that it's certainly a common reaction. So did the system serve your mother the way she expected it to?
No, it didn't.
Well, what went wrong there?
Right. Unfortunately, we found out that it absolutely does not work that way. And even through many months of my brother waiting for his trial, we still, once again naively, kept thinking that it was all going to just work out fine and the truth would be heard and everything would work out accordingly.
Well, let's just talk about a few things about the justice system. How long was it between when your brother was arrested and when he was actually sentenced?
7 months.
7 months. Mm-hmm. So for 7 months, you kept believing, oh, this is going to be okay. This is going to be okay. When did that faith start to wane? Did it take very long or did you stay hopeful right till the last day?
Well, we stayed fairly hopeful. His attorney did tell us that in what we consider for his case, a he said, she said type of case, that it's always an uphill battle to actually for the defendant to prove his innocence.
Mm-hmm.
They call those crucible cases.
Right. And did you feel that
like
you had?
Like back in the witch hunt days.
That's true, right. Did you feel like you had good representation, that you were listened to and got to tell whatever it was you had to say?
Well, our representation was okay. It wasn't great.
Uh-huh.
But as far as going in front, he only had a judge. He did not have a full jury.
Mm-hmm. Was that his choice, or is that just the way his case was handled?
That was recommended by his attorney.
So that was a choice that the attorney advised him to make.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And we didn't know any different. We went by what he recommended.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was, only up to the judge and...
Uh-huh.
No, we didn't feel he heard the whole story.
And then when it came to the time of sentencing, did he get a sentence about what you expected, or were you kind of taken back by how long it would be?
No, his sentence, even if the crime had been committed, is considerably out of line.
Really?
Yes.
And how many years is he in lockdown for?
Over 8 years.
And how long has he been there so far?
7.
Well, it's getting near the end at least. So what does your family do? Do you go visit him and you still love him and everything?
We do. We go visit him and try to keep his spirits up.
Mm-hmm.
And
do you think that's bonding for your family to say, look, we all have to hang together because one of us needs all of us?
Yes. It has brought us together in a different kind of way that we didn't know that we were going to be a part of, but it's actually it's had some positive things happen to us. I have to say that in light of the challenge for my brother,
mm-hmm.
the way he's handling it, we couldn't be more proud of.
Well, that's beautiful to hear. I hope that word gets to him. You let him know all the time you're proud of him. Because I think it takes a lot of faith to continue to behave in a way that sometimes you wonder, what am I doing here? Why am I doing this? And so on. And a little encouragement from the family gives him some of the courage that he needs.
Right.
I'm sure that's why they call it encouragement, you know. Well, Debbie, tell me, how about your mother? How did it make her feel? Was she devastated once sentence was given?
We were devastated. We were confused. Uh-huh. We realized how much we absolutely did not know about the justice system. We lost our faith in the system.
Uh-huh.
And,
you know, I once worked with a group of folks who were kind of, they just gathered together to talk over their problems. And in starting our discussion, I would ask the group, what's the worst thing that ever happened to you? And we'd go around the circle, and one person would say, the time my husband fell out of a tree, and the time my kid got pneumonia, and the time my uncle was in an auto accident. Well, everything that they had to say was about a time that someone in their family was very badly hurt, either through health or accident or mental stress or something. Nobody ever said the time I had a heart attack or the time I fell out of a tree or They all, the most stress that they could recall was the pain they felt because someone that they loved was in trouble. And when I say to you, how did your mother feel? How did you feel? Is that hard for you to understand when I tell that story? Or
no.
Do you think that's exactly what happened, that the ordeal and the working with this problem that your husband, that your brother had to confront was something that you all went through?
Right.
You know, Bo Lazoff likes to say, we're all doing their time.
Right.
And
you almost honestly feel like it is happening to you, and
uh-huh.
it's happening. It is. It's happening to your family, and it affects every single one of us.
So, hello, Debbie. How are you? And, oh, we got 8 years, you know, right?
Right.
Right. Right. Well, I hope everyone out there understands that. I think that a lot of folks don't encounter actual people who are convicted of felons or serving time for felons. But I wonder if they realize how many people they have encounters with who have a loved one or a family member that is. There's over 167,000 children in public schools who have at least one parent in lockdown. So it wouldn't be hard to imagine that somewhere in your child's school or classroom is someone whose parent is in lockdown. And a thoughtless word or a thoughtless attitude like, duh, if they're in jail, they must have done something wrong. They deserve what
uh-huh.
they get. You know, there's a lot of people out there who say, no, 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 no.
Yeah, well, everybody should have to experience what we saw one day after visiting my brother, seeing a little 4-year-old child being ripped out of her father's arms, crying mm-hmm. her eyes out.
Oh, my. Oh, my. Because the mother was going to be sent away, right?
It's terrible.
Yeah. Well, we're going to lighten up for just a few minutes, and then I want to go back and hear some more about your mother. The first thing I wanted to know, I want to be sure that all our listeners take advantage of the web when they can, take advantage of various resource centers that can give them information, comfort, assistance. And one that's very well known has been the Western Prison Project, and recently they've changed their name, so I hope that everyone out there who has ever relied on the Western Prison Project as a source for information knows that it's now called the Partnership for Safety and Justice. And if they're going to the web or they're looking in the phone book or they're calling information or they see advertisements for fundraisers or something, that they should understand that the Partnership for Safety and Justice is the very same organization that used to be called the Western Prison Project. And then there's another one that I think is very well known, FAM. You want to tell us what that is, Debbie? I bet you know.
Yeah, that's Families Against Mandatory Minimums. And they work very hard at getting legislation changed about the minimum sentencing laws. They're a great resource for helping you send letters to your legislators, making them aware of what your priorities are as far as prison reform.
Mm-hmm. How do we get in touch with them?
They are...
They're on the web at FAMM,
F-A-M-M.
.com, is that it?
Let's see. It is, yes. www.famm.org.
.org. Okay, very good. I'm glad we got that straight. And do you search the web for other organizations sometimes? You find them?
I do. I look around to see who else has different agendas going on. The other one is CURE.
And what's CURE stand for?
CURE is Citizens United for the Rehabilitation of Errants.
Okay.
And they are actually, they're one of the very first people that we went to find out how to kind of negotiate your way around the prison system.
I see. So, you know, they say knowledge is power. Has looking at the web and reading all this stuff about Measure 11 and so on, has that been helpful to you?
It has. What it does is when you're kind of in disbelief and confusion and anger, it helps to focus some of that into something positive, and you have other folks around you that are going through the same thing.
I see.
And you can all focus your strengths towards something positive and help each other.
Oh, that's good. I'm sure it's not hard to find someone who is willing to share their thoughts with you when you get yourself channeled into one of these organizations.
Right.
You know, we started our program tonight with the Joan Baez song, Prison Trilogy. It was a favorite of Ann Rose Pierce. Ann Rose Pierce was the person who first had this program, Prison Pipeline, and she passed away last year. And every time we play the Joan Baez piece, we kind of remember her and all the work she did toward prison reform. And there are some leaders out there, certainly the organizers and the people who manage these programs. We've just mentioned FAM and CURE and Partners for Safety and Justice and many others that we didn't mention, that it's the hard work of these folks that is the only way that we're going to get any change or reform going. I want to get back to your mother now.
Okay.
So what does your mother do now that she's accepting all of this?
The first thing we had to do is really educate ourselves about the system. We're still working our way through it. But educating ourselves and also others, too. We realized how much we didn't know, so we know that other people don't know anything about this either.
Well, you told me about Measure 11 once. Now, what was that? That was something you learned after your brother was incarcerated.
Right, Measure 11 with the mandatory minimum sentencing laws.
What's that about?
For person-to-person crimes in Oregon, that was a law that was passed where it basically takes the sentencing out of the hands of the judges, and there's already mandatory minimum sentencing set aside for the person-to-person crimes. It means that you go to prison for that set amount of time. You don't have any good time. You do all your time, and then when you get out, you're on probation and not on parole.
Uh-huh.
So you don't get any sort of parole.
Well, I thought one of the biggest objections to Measure 11 is it took a lot of the discretionary power out of the hands of the judges. It used to be, without this mandatory sentencing ruling, that if two young men came before a judge on the same day, we'll say for a crime involving drugs, and it was the same dollar amount of drugs, and it was the second offense for both, and they were in the same age group, the mandatory sentencing thing will probably give them the same sentence. But if the judge was allowed to listen to all the facts and find out that one had a mental disability, or one came from a home where drugs were so prevalent that he just got into the drug, you know, all these special stories, that he might use some discretionary power and give one a lighter sentence than the other. But with
right.
mandatory sentencing, that just doesn't happen. And that's part of why Families Against Mandatory Minimums is so active and has so much support. So I hear about a flyer your mother made. You want to tell me about that?
Yeah, she made a little flyer that she takes with her, and she's actually gone down to the courthouses and handed them out to people. And it says, "My family is yet another victim of Measure 11." And she has in there that it's a one strike and you're out law, because it is. A lot of people think it's the three strikes you're out law. That's not it. It's one strike, you're out. And it says, "The truth is spoken but not heard. Repeal Measure 11.
So is your mother one of those radical activists that goes to marches and parades and stands on street corners all her life? Or
no.
Is this out of character for her a little
bit? It's very out of character for her.
Really?
It's very new for us. We're pretty fairly quiet people that kind of just went along and our daily lives and kind of did our thing. And
faith in the system.
Right. Uh-huh. And so this is new for us. And, you know, one thing, another thing about Measure 11, just a kind of a little statistic, is that 60% of the people in prison for Measure 11 are first-time offenders.
Is that right? And how many years have they been given? It varies depending on the crime.
I believe the minimum is 5 years.
Okay.
Or like an assault charge, let's say.
Uh-huh. I see. Hmm. 60% of them. Wow.
60%. Mm-hmm.
Are they men and women both? Some of each? Do you think that this 60% represents some men and some women persons? Are you with me? Yeah.
Probably mostly men.
You just never checked it out, I guess. Mm-hmm. Okay. So how else do you support your brother? Is there some other action your mother's taken that you want to tell us about?
Well, I mean, the most important is visiting him.
Mm-hmm.
We drive 3.5-4 hours each way to go visit him. We get 3-hour visit a day. And he calls us and we write him.
We talked about some of this the last time you were on, but maybe not all our listeners were tuned in that night. When he calls you, I think we mentioned, what does a phone call cost?
Oh, they're very expensive. If he needs to call collect, it's usually $2.50 to $3 a minute.
A minute?
Mm-hmm.
And how long does he talk?
You can talk, I think it's up to 15 or 20 minutes at a time, I believe.
So if he even takes 10 minutes of that, it's $25, right?
Right,
for a phone call.
And they do have calling cards that we put money on, but it doesn't save a lot. It's still a couple dollars a minute.
Is that right?
But at least it doesn't charge the person that they're calling.
I see. So it gives them a little more leeway that he can call anyone instead of just someone that he knows will accept the charges, right?
Because some towns, their phones are not set up to even take collect calls.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember when working with Ann Rose Pierce that sometimes folks in prison wanted to just call up and order a book or a treat of food or something like a cheesecake or whatever. And when they would call the place of business, the person wouldn't accept their call, you know. And
right.
And having the phone card takes care of things like that, right? And then
we try to do other things. You know, we try to get a hold of his appeals attorney just to kind of find out how things are going that way and to let him know that we're here and thinking about him.
Mm-hmm.
We actually had to write letters to the judge that sentenced him because he sentenced him incorrectly. So we ended up writing letters and having to get that changed.
Well, what changed? Did you get the time shortened that way? Or
right.
How much?
They had given him 3 more years than what he was supposed to have been sentenced.
Really? And who brought that to your attention? Your attorney?
No. My brother actually noticed it. And we got a hold of the Department of Corrections.
Mm-hmm.
And we weren't really getting anywhere with them. They said that we needed to contact the judge. So we all wrote letters to the judge, and the judge ended up getting it corrected on his end.
Well, being informed of the procedures is very important. And when we think of some of the folks who are involved in crime and come from a poverty setting and a criminal setting, they don't know all this. You know, they get dragged into court and they don't have good representation. And if the judge says you got 23 years, they say, oh, darn, I got 23 years. And they don't even know enough to fight it or appeal it or where to look it up to see if that was fair or appropriate, right? So at least the encouragement and the backing you're giving your brother has kept him on top of these situations.
And right.
That's certainly a good thing. So I want to thank you for sharing with us. Is there any last thing you'd like to say? And otherwise I'll do my closing statements.
The only other thing that I'd like to say is that, one of the ladies at the Partnership for Safety and Justice kind of summed it up for us one night, and, you know, we all go around saying, you know, there's no justice, and she said, no, there is no justice, there's just us.
Oh, that's very good.
That is the truth.
And didn't you get a letter from FAM? Did you want to tell me about that?
I did get a letter from FAM, and they're very excited about the Democratic change in the House of the Senate and the House of Representatives.
Do they think the Democrats are going to be easier to work with for prison reform?
They do feel like that they're going to be able to have a little more say in some of the maybe upcoming bills. But they did say they do have some very positive relationships with the Republican lawmakers, too.
Mm-hmm.
So they just are very excited, and they feel like there might be some more doors opened for collaboration on some of the more smart sentencing bills. So,
well, I try to keep on top of information that I think the Prison Pipeline listening audience would be interested in. And I play with Google a lot, and I just put in a thing like prison reform laws. And I came up with quite a listing, quite a choice of things to read about what legislation is going on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So,
All we can do is keep reminding our, even in our own state and our legislators, what's important to us. And, of course, those of us that are interested in the prison reform, we bring it to their attention every chance we get, how we feel. So,
well, and what every one of us must do is support our loved ones who are in lockdown.
That's right.
Visit them.
Probably one of
write
the
to them.
Most important things to do.
Love them. Send them messages. Trust them, and so on. Well, thanks again, Debbie, for sharing with us, not just last time, but this time. And send my greetings and my thanks to your mother and to your brother, and tell your family to stay strong and keep spreading the word. And I'll say goodbye to you right now.
Thank you, Ruth, and thank you to your listeners. And everybody, please get involved.
Okay. So, Prison Pipeline folks, be sure to listen again next week. We're going to have Reggae Bob, and Prison Pipeline is reaching out to you. And if you reach back to us, give us a call, send us a letter. But we're going to go out with some music by Ruth Brown. It's a good day for the blues. And thanks for listening to Ruth Kovach on Prison Pipeline. Good night.
I got a bird this morning, so I could walk the floor. I got to hit the streets, 'cause there's a wolf outside my door. The bill collector's calling, and my kids need better shoes. Gonna go to church on Sunday. It's a good day.
outside, and I'm looking for a job. The man I've worked for laid me off. Lord, and I've worked for him real hard. But I won't let my kids go hungry, no matter what I have to do. And it's a good day. Day for the blues.